Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank you for showing up and for the Digital Architects to invite me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first time in Prague, actually. And and after a lot of technical problems we had here, it seems always be the same. My laptop didn't work here, so we had to transfer everything on the other laptop. And so I have to apologize that the movies are not embedded now in the presentations. We have to restart them. And sometimes some things might not work. But anyway, that's how it is in the digital work. And that's how we start. So the title today is Real as Data. And and some delays. Well, this is kind of the vision we have. If there's a sense of reality, there must also be a sense of possibility. This is by Robert Musil. It's from The Man Without Qualities. And it gives you an idea that what we're talking about is about the possibilities and about something which is, in a way, essential. So that we kind of develop the sense for the possibilities that are in a given task. Okay. So this is how the story started. In 1993, I did research in the field of the influence of digital media on architecture. And actually, this was an installation we did that time in the Technical University of Darmstadt called Netzstadt, a connection of two rooms over a set of computers by Silicon Graphics, video machinery. And it was an interactive computer installation called Netzstadt. But it had no gestalt, it had no form. So then, because of this, the Institute of New Media gave me a chance that I became artist in residence in the Städel Art School, the so-called Institute for New Media. And this was the time when Jurassic Park came out and The Terminator. And when I discovered that the potential of animation software as a design tool. Actually, the software at that time was Explorer, and what these movie people do, when they want to create a storm in a scenery like here, and then they have this background, and then they could start imagining how a storm would look like. But if the storm would be modeled, then it would take years to model just a single storm. So they say we are smart, we know the laws of physics, so we just take the laws of physics and then we simulate a storm. And this we simulate by using physical forces. So what they do a dynamic simulation instead of modeling. So they first make in some background, and then they create this here, this storm, just by physical laws. And so what I did is that I took the same software and used forces which are not from the physical world, which are somewhere from more remote influences. And the very first project I did was in 1995, this called Skylink Frankfurt project. And this was like a net elevated between the skyscrapers of Frankfurt. And this net, the form of the net was a dynamic net. And the morphogenesis was through force simulation. So the form of this is not modeled, it's done by a force simulation. And the forces were driven by the server traffic on the server of the Institute for New Media. In fact, this was a wormhole installation, so this was something which was online, in the internet, interactively. So this was not a representation of a digital city, this was the digital city. And this is how it started in 1995. This is when I got to know Lars Beilbrook, Greg Lynn, all the Dutch guys, and since then we are somehow working in the same field. But because of the work I did some teaching in academics. Like, I was assistant professor at the Technical University of Darmstadt, and guest professor in Kassel, and I was guest critic at the ETH and with Marc Angelil at the Städel, with Ben van Berkel at the TU Darmstadt for Schulankulatan. Then I was teaching at the Academy of Fine Arts in Stuttgart, and I was guest professor in SciArt Los Angeles. In the professional field, by 1996, we got a commission by BMW. And since I was a single person, they told me, if you want to work for us, you need somebody to back you up. So I went to a major office in Frankfurt called ABB Architekten, and we did the first projects together. And so from 1996 to 2000, I was project director for ABB Architekten. And from 2000 to 2002, we had a joint venture. And since 2002, we are completely independent as Franken Architekten. The works we do exhibition pavilions, we do fair stands, we do flagship stores, factory outlets, retail concepts, brand academies, office buildings. So this was more the general information. What I want to talk about tonight is the digital production chain. The digital production chain in our office has five steps. It's brief, process, form, digital manufacturing, and experience. And the consistency of brief and experience, because of this, this we have the digital continuity, because the client is only interested in the brief and the experience. And because of the digital production chain in between, we make sure that whatever he has briefed is actually then in the end in the experience. A very important part of this is the so-called parametric design. This starts with the definition of parameters, then a search for a process. Then there's a couple of feedback loops. And these feedback loops are reacting to forces outside the physical space deriving from the information space. Forces. Why do we work with forces? Actually, we can say we have no sense for forces. So the forces that are right now working here in the ceiling, you cannot really see. You cannot smell. You cannot taste, you cannot feel. But if the ceiling would be bent, then you could tell that something very heavy must be on top of you. So forces are felt by their effects only. And our mind is highly conditioned to see the effect of forces. So if you see these trees, they are perfectly perpendicular, just going straight up. If you see the same trees here, you can tell, even without hearing, that there must be some force coming from here. And your mind is conditioned. If this is happening, there might be a danger. So you immediately feel a force in a form if the form is bent. So what we do is we use this for communication purposes. Since the generating forces are embedded in the form, they communicate directly with the user. So a deformation can become an information. And so we use this in our buildings, which are highly communicative, that we hide forces in the form so they are felt later by the users. And this is an example of a wave we did in Munich for BMW for the Expo 2000. And you can actually feel the forces when you're inside of this building. The first project we were able to build, because I would say in the field of digital architects, we had been the lucky ones that actually built stuff. I mean, most of the people just do nice renderings or models, and since we found a client, we had the chance to build something. And when you start building, then the real pain starts. So this is the form generation of the so-called bubble. So we started out with a metaphor that we wanted to create a bubble. But the form of the bubble was then simulated. It was not modeled. It was simulated using a plugin by Explore that time, using Metadrops. So these are actually the forces that have been at work. It's the surface tension. It's the cohesion of the two bodies, and it's gravitation. And then the form was not directly manipulated, but just manipulated by changing the parameters of these forces. And what came out was the so-called master geometry. So this here was the result of the simulation, and then we claimed this to be holy, that no one was supposed to change this any longer. And then came the structural engineers of Wollinger & Grohmann, and then first we did some analysis of the form. This is a finite element simulation of the final structure. This was a finite element simulation of just the skin. And then we found out something very interesting. Since the form is not optimized for the forces of the physical space, its origin is from the information space, there is a missing force. So actually here you can see this red part in the finite element simulation. Here you have tensions which are very, very high. And these tensions actually would force the form to bend in. So what we do now, we push it back, and we are not optimizing this shell, that there's an equal force in each part, but we deliberately push it back and we say, okay, it doesn't matter that there are tensions, and suddenly you see forces which are actually not there. So in this way, in doing something with the engineers that is a little bit against their code of honor, because the engineers always want to have an optimized form for the forces, we are able to show forces which are not from this world. And so this was further on. Then in CATIA, we did the panelization of the form. And since this is a complete NURB, a complete free form, we had 305 different of these panels. And the actual panel size was related to the available block of foam, which has this size, and the available panel size, which is this. And this is the final panel we wanted to have. And then we milled 305 of these blocks, of these molds. This is the final mold. And then a panel of acrylic glass was heated in an oven. This is actually the panel flying in the air, coming down. It's like 20 millimeters thick. And then it was cooled down on the form. And then this was still quite imprecise. So the next step is that this whole thing went under the milling machine again, was seamed on all edges, and then we got an accuracy which was beyond the accuracy you could reach on the construction side. So we learned from this project that since the digital manufactured stuff is so precise, we have to build in tolerances into that. So finally, on the construction side, you can match the things together. And this was then the final barbe. And then, of course, when you work with free forms, then you have normal architectural questions like something like how to build a door into something which is double curved on all sides. And we had made different experiments with kind of airplane-like hinges and all kinds of stuff to open this door, but we didn't manage. And finally, we ended up doing it like on the computer, doing it like the CD-ROM drive that we placed everything under it on the floor and had a door which was just sliding open. And this was the bubble then on the side. This actually, we did everything which was in here, we did everything which was in the tent, but this is the stuff we got known for, this bubble. And then the bubble was part of the Expo 2000 in Munich, and this time it served as a nightclub, as a discotheque, which was very good for Munich because well, you couldn't get past the doorman, but you could see who was inside. So it was something for the hedonistic Munich people. This was the interior of the bubble then, serving as a club. So the next project I'm going to show you is the Klöp project, which is more maybe like something of what you would call a building. It's a ministry's office in Reykjavik in Iceland. We won an international competition, and they wanted us to build it. Again, I have to show the movie separately. So this is downtown of Reykjavik, and this is the site in question. And here, right opposite to the site, there was a rock. And this rock is supposed to be some trolls living there. And so we said, this is nice, so we give these trolls some force field. And then we wanted a connection of the street and this courtyard. We gave them two force fields as well. And then we just took the site, the outer shape of the site, created a matrix out of it, and transformed it by the forces of the trolls and the two streets. And this process is not stopped at any point, but it is actually reaching a standstill. And then we said, okay, this standstill, this final position, this is the one we were going to take for the project. And then we took out line, we selected lines out of this, and then we used the site again and elevated like a block out of it, extruded a block, and cut the block by these lines. And then we used the finer structure of the same grid to create the facade. And so it ended up that these two canyons, we call them, were facing this troll rock. And this canyon is actually making the connection between the courtyard and the street. Talking about trolls, actually, there's a government official in Iceland mapping all countryside for troll rocks, for elves, for giants, for dwarfs, and you're not supposed to build on these sites. And the Icelandic people, on the other hand, are very fancy of all kinds of gadgets like internet, like handies, mobiles. And so they're very modern-orientated on one hand and very traditional on the other hand. And if you would ask an Icelander, do you believe in trolls, he would say no. But if you tell him, would you build your house on a troll rock, he would say no, because you never know. And so we thought that this funny mixture of traditional belief and something which is not there, using in a computer-driven force field generation of a form, was quite appealing to them because it was mixing the two extremes they are dealing with. And the other idea for the facade was the idea of using the basalt layers of the island, because the island is completely of volcanic origin. And as you can see, this is actually the design of the facades in the competition coming from the grid, the distorted grid. And there was, on one hand, this more horizontal orientation, and on the other hand, there was the pixelization. And the horizontal orientation is more or less like in classical architecture, in modernism, these horizontal lines, like here a building of Mendelssohn. And on the other hand, it's like a punch hole facade, like in this building in Rome. Actually, it's a fascist building, but a very nice building, with this punch hole facade. And we wanted something which is neither this nor that, something which is, again, not architectural, not typologically, but a hybrid, a mix of something. And in a quite complicated process, because, you know, the master geometry is holy, we are not allowed to change the master geometry, so we did some computerized processes to come from the more crooked lines to the straight lines, but the crooked lines were kind of governing where the facade is jumping in and out. So this is again completely computer-driven, but a derivative of an higher order of the same process. And we believe that still the same forces are inside and still like tangible. You don't know actually what is happening there, but you are getting a feeling that there is some order behind it, some very complex order, but there is order. This is not just arbitrary. This is the model. And again, it was a quite close work together with the structural engineers. This time it was the Office for Structural Design in Darmstadt, OSD, which is like an off-spin from Bollinger & Grohmann, the project director that always worked with us, founded his own office. And in a way, we are very strict. We have this VisiVig feeling that what you see is what you get. So we wanted actually everything which was stone in the facade to be concrete behind it, and everything which was glass should be a hole. So this made it, of course, more complicated, but most of the times we are solving problems we are creating ourselves. But then we had the problem that you have these long stripes here and red areas here where there is too high tensions. And so we ended up with a very informal structural system that we used everything which is there, like the distorted canyon walls were perfect against the earthquakes. And then we had some places in between where we could fill the facade to build out these diagonals. And again, we have some like hidden rules in our office, some do's and don'ts. And what we are allowed to do, we are allowed to interpret the master geometry. So we are allowed to decide should it be glass or should it be stone, but we are not allowed to say glass should be here or there, but only where the geometry already is. But so we were allowed to decide that this part here is stone because we needed the stone here to have this diagonal. And so in a jumping back and forth, we came up with this facade. And later on, then we had a PhD student from the ETH in Zurich that actually developed an algorithm to do this in the computer. So if you do this, if you would do the, would have to do this project again, then we could start immediately with the program and not have to do it in jumping back and forth. But actually, it's, what we kind of do is not really, it doesn't have to be in the computer. The question is more, is it based on rules? Is it a rule-based behavior? And the rules are given by ourselves, but then we very strictly follow the rules. Okay, and this is the further development of the facade. I will spare explaining this to you. This is some of the inside of the interior. Since it should appear like being in a stone, then it should be that everything which is built in is more or less like applied to the building. So this is all concrete, and only this part here is like furniture built in. So this is how it assembles. And then there was another thing in the canyons. Each of the canyons had a theme. The first canyon had the theme of water, people walking on glass over water. The second canyon had the theme of hot stones, because in Iceland, the hot water is delivered directly to the buildings out of geothermic springs. So it smells a little like volcanic too. And this hot water we would use in the stones with small cutouts so people can come out from the cold winter and sit first in the stones and warm up. And the last canyon had the theme of vegetation, which is quite important in Iceland as well. So in a way, we treated the government of Iceland like a brand, like BMW. And the government should explain in the building a little bit about its purpose, which is representing the people of Iceland, representing Iceland to foreigners. So the building is giving some glimpses on what's happening in Iceland. And this is about the canyon glazing. I will skip this a little. But in these canyons, we had then platforms, because from some spot you have to see all this. And these platforms were more or less like cantilevered platforms. They are only connected here to the structure. They are completely cantilevered in this direction, so it's more like a diving board jumping from. And then these platforms are used for informal meetings, and to give people not the feeling of being too exposed on this, then you have these indentions in the platform, which is more or less like a sushi corner where you can sit down. This is a view from below, and you can see that actually the facade is going in between the cantilevered platforms. And then this was connected to sidelines. This is a section here. You can see the sushi corner. And the idea was a little bit like this stealth yacht by Valle, which has 26,000 horsepower and is like 40 meters long. And so this atmosphere we would like to create. And last not least, now I will skip this one because I have it in a better way, and jump to this one. And this is again a project for BMW. It's an installation at the Munich Airport. And this time you were asked to do something which is in between art and brand communication, telling something about the nature of BMW. And it was for the Terminal 2 of the new Munich Airport. and it was supposed to be an elevated object in the air of the entry hall. And it was supposed to be like 150 meters or 100 meters long. And the idea here was that of a shifting image. So I don't know if you had these as kids. We had them in Germany, these images. Then we moved them, then they changed, like Superman to Batman and back. And we used this idea. So you had lamellas, and each side of the lamellas is mapped with a different image, and just by walking by, the image is changing. So this is how we started. And this developed further. This is the entry hall of the Munich airport. Actually, it's this part here, which is like 250 meters in this direction, 150 meters in this direction. And we analyzed where the passengers come from. And we found out they come from four different directions. We made a simulation of the passengers walking in there. And then we defined hotspots. And these hotspots, from these hotspots, the object should be perfectly visible. Actually, it was four hotspots, another one here on the platform. And then we took this image, transformed into the lamellas, and transformed it by the forces. And this was then used to create this effect. This is one of the passengers coming from the taxi drop-off. And first you see one image when you enter. You still see the one image. But as soon as you pass the hotspot, suddenly the image is flipping. So without any mechanics, just by optokinetical effects, the image is changing. And then you see the other image. And so they can use the device in telling small stories that can be told by two images. This time it was the desert and the Alps. And now I think we have the fourth image already applied on there. So in this case, the master geometry was much more complicated. This is actually the master geometry. This is the lamella. And each of the lamellas, 363 lamellas, so they're all different length, from 2.50 meters to 6 meters, are driven by this simulation. And when you look a little closer, then you can see that here on this side, these are the parameters of the lamella. And these parameters are read out and used for the actual production. And the whole structure is governed by these tubes. And these tubes, actually, if they change, all the lamellas change. And then in the production process, these tubes were bent by a bending company in the Netherlands. And then we found out the tolerances were too high. So what we had to do, we had to measure the actual bent tubes and redo the complete computer model again to get 363 new sets of data for the production of the lamellas. And if this model would not have been parametric, then we would have been dead. We would have just been gone. So this is the advantage of using parametrics, that you can change in the project certain parameters and still use the same data again. So this is actually out of the sight of a camera fixed to the lamella. And you can see that in the lamella, we have here sections, and these sections are regular. So the skin is always changing, but the sections are repetitive. So
The whole production was a mixture of using repetitive parts, which were inside here. Then we had a central axis, and they were twisted around the axis. And then we had these, the cover, and the cover were all different. The cover was done by laser cutting, each of them different, and these were, in a way, a repetitive element, these sections in between. And here you can see some of the 363 different lamellas, each of them having a different cut at the edges, and they look a little bit like, finally we found Saddam Hussein's smoking guns, but they're just lamellas. And then we came up to another problem, with this structure, which is like 26 tons heavy, and then we needed a cleaning device going past the cables, and then we had these spots here, and at these spots we had like coming cables from six different angles. And we couldn't find a way geometrically solve it in a single node. So what we had to do is we created a parametric node. So this parametric node, it's like a chewing gum part in between. And this chewing gum part is changing depending on the directions of the cables coming from. And actually, this is how it was done later. Some of the nodes were actually bent steel, and some of them were milled. So this is the data model of the parametric node. This part in between is using the Maya tool cloth. Cloth is used for character animation, that a coat you're wearing is going with the character, and we kind of misused this to create this node. This is a shaded version. This is the finite element analysis, and it turned out that if this spot was too big, too red, then you had to increase the thickness a little until everything was in the green. And this is actually a block of steel. This is the part which is kept. And this node is almost as big as I am. So this is a huge node. And this is the one hanging in space. So from here to here, it's like 1 meter and 70. 16 of these, all different. And this is the final thing hanging in Munich. And I don't know, if you still have patience, I could show you the other project which was deleted from the other file. Yes. You do? Okay. Actually, here I would have to improvise a little because now the translation to English is gone. And I will skip some of the slides. But this is for a flagship store in Munich. We just finished like 4 weeks ago. It's called Home Couture. And the briefing of the client, I mean, maybe some of you know German. Actually, it was by Raab Karcher. Raab Karcher is it's a dealer for Baustoffe, for construction goods, and he's dealing with tiles, for instance. He's dealing with sheet metal, with everything you need for building a building, and he belongs to the Saint-Gobain Group, which is one of the biggest companies in the world, under the 100 biggest companies of the world, and nobody knows them, and they want to change that. So they said, we take the format of the flagship store and create our own flagship store with some premium partners we have for tiles. And it should be a flagship store for tiles and for bathroom accessoires and armatures and stuff. So this is the direct neighborhood. It's in Berlin on the Kudamm. And in the direct neighborhood, you have like flagship stores of the haute couture, like Versace, Louis Vuitton, Hermes. And this is the site map. And the good thing about it was that we had 60 meters of window.
And the bad thing was that this was a building from the 60s and not very attractive. But this is the main facade to the Kudamm, the main shopping area, or the fine shopping area in Munich. This is the entrance. Berlin, sorry. And actually, this was the second facade, which was not so popular. This was the building from outside. This was the one facade, and the long facade. This was the interior as we found it, a run-down fashion shop. And the back was almost like a soccer field, unstructured, very deep, very dark. So, oh, this is difficult to translate, but this was the idea we took from Charles Baudelaire for the perfect flaneur, the passionate surveyor. It is an enormous pleasure to take presence in the multiplicity, in the liquid, in the movement, in the ephemeral, in the eternal. And what we wanted to do is actually, I skip all of this, we wanted to create a huge window for window shopping and use the movement of people to create the form. So this is the flaneur walking by the facade, and because of his perspective, the facade is unfolding. And then we took sight lines from the flaneur going by. Well, first we extruded the transformed facade, and then we took sight lines from his move around the facade, and then we cut it, like in the Kloe project. And then there was something left, like a wall, which was cut in different places. And these are from the renderings we did for the presentations. And then we had another process, which was done for the facade to the Kudamm. We used the view of the walking by flaneur to change an acrylic glass. And then when you walk down by the acrylic glass, it is working like a lens or like a vertical plane of water you're looking through on the ground of a swimming pool, and you see the back distorted like looking through a wavy surface of a swimming pool. So this is the wall, which is actually giving like two stripes. And by this we are creating a layering of areas. There's a more informal area to enter the shop. Then there's a second area for more deeper product presentation. And then there's this final area which is used for the partners to do their presentation in their own corporate identity. And then we have a lounge in the front part, which is more for having a cafe, having like a library situation. This is the model. Here you can see the lounge. Here you can see the back part and the partners. And then we not just did the architecture. We did the whole naming. We did the CI. We did all the graphics for that, called Home Couture. This is now the interior. And again, it's like in all our projects, each of these is again different. Each of this is milled in a computer-driven, but this time 2D router. So it's even if it's not a blob shape, it's still a digital architecture, and still the same idea behind it, that you have a simulation, and from the simulation you have a form, and the form is directly translated into the construction data, production data, creating a space which has this process kind of hidden in there, and so people feel that something is different there. And then we have the lines on the floor, which are, again, from the same process, the lines here, the lines in here. So all the lines are in correspondence. And these are one of the sight lines going into the depth. This is the way back, looking back to the facade. And then we have the so-called tile servers, and each of the tile servers, well, these panels, sometimes these panels are replaced by panels from which are used for product for showing the products of the partners. And in some situations, these panels can be interactively taken out. And then they are cantilevered like 2 meter long slabs of tiles going out. So again, one of the partners. I go on fast here. And this is again the liquid lounge in the front part. The lounge situation with some lifestyle literature. All this furniture is again after the sight lines. And then the liquid tiles installation. As I said, the client wanted a media installation in the facade, but he didn't have the money for it, and he didn't have the culture for it, so he had no stock material or anything to use in a media installation. So we said, let's do an optic kinetical installation in the tradition of the op art. So more no-tech instead of high-tech, and which should be like an eye-catcher. So this is more or less having some nearness to these optic-kinetical art pieces. And this is how we started, using the tiles, which are rigid. But the whole shop was dealing about water, and water is soft, and water is in movement. And then we said if we have water in movement, then it creates double curved surfaces. And these double curved surfaces, they create refraction. And so together, the tiles and the water, they create liquefied tiles. So this was actually the idea behind this, which you have already seen, which we skip. This is then, again, the digital production process. We took acrylic panels like 60 millimeters long, and we milled out the structure out of it. So what was left was then more or less like a lens. And this is now the final in the facade. And this is the night view of the facade. Oh, it's running. And this is a small movie, what is happening when people are walked by. And actually, it gives people a smile on the face when they look in there. And like children take their parents and go there and say, look, what's happening there? So what you saw there was not a simulation, this was real. And this is how I finished. Thank you very much. Feel free to ask me any questions, because when I was in this lecture in Moscow, nobody asked, and I was wondering why, but they told me later this is not in the culture. In the past, always the people on the front desk, they are right. What they say is right, so don't ask them anything. But here, you can ask me whatever you want to.
So any questions? Go on.
I still have a question about the rectangular things which you cut from by CNC machines, and about the budget, isn't it? Because I understand using the machines for the free form shapes, but I have a little bit kind of problem with the rectangular ones, and also concerning the budget, is it more expensive, or was it like let's say, I don't know, just a few percent more expensive than to make it regular?
No, actually, it depends, of course, on the kind of contractor you're working with. But the company we found in Berlin is always using this method. But they use it normally to create things that are all the same. So the only difference is that we had to come up with a set of data to create everything different. And of course, it's a little bit more handling and assembly and stuff, but it was not more expensive than just normal off-the-rack, straightforward shop. So it creates more work for the architect, which is not paid, but it's not actually more expensive. And even the freeform stuff is not really more expensive, but if you see this Dynaform, for instance, let me scroll there. In front of the Dynaform, there was a small building for Mini, for the other brand of BMW. And this Mini building was just a normal industrial container-like structure with glass, facades, and here, this part here, and steel. And per square meter, this was more expensive than this. Just because membrane is such a cheap material, of course. But what we saved in the surface, we could put into the more complex manufacturing of the steel. So it's not true that digital architecture has to be more expensive. It only needs more brains, maybe, to find ways to work around. Any more questions?
How did you achieve the smooth-looking acrylic in the Kudam Street? It was milled from the 60 millimeters
acrylic, and yeah. Was it laser cut?
Just polished by hands.
Just polished after? Mm-hmm.
This is the beauty about acrylic glass, that if you have a cut or anything, you can polish everything out.
And manual.
And, well, first they use like four different milling pointers, and a very smooth one in the end. So it's already quite a smooth surface, and then they start milling it with paper, sandpaper, and finally a very thin, which is not even a sandpaper, which is just out of a tube, some like toothpaste, almost, and then they polish it.
My question is, well, there is no doubt that your buildings, for example, this one or the building in Iceland, they're somehow connected to the place, the exact site, and there's no way you can take these buildings and put somewhere else where, because...
But didn't you listen? I mean, this building here is bent was done by forces on the site.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
The connection in Iceland between the street and the courtyard was on the side.
So the question is there a certain specific like approach what you do if you go to the site and are you trying to look for some like specifics of that place and try to you know, come up with a inspiration or something like that?
Well, I think designing is always a matter of deciding. That you, as the designer, go somewhere and you decide what is important there. And there's nothing like objectivity in designing. Designing is always subjective. And you, as the designer, you have to make decisions all of the time. And so it's up to you to decide if this is important or not. And of course, we are going there and we are trying to find something which is the possibility. That's, you know, why we have this vision in the front, that we have this sense for possibility. And this is something, of course, that is developing by education, which is maybe a gift that you have by intuition, but something I think all designers should develop, that you have a given task and you have like you smell the possibilities that are in there. And then you try to work on the whole setting that these possibilities come up and that something like beauty is created.
Okay, Bernard, thank you very much for joining us this evening, and have a good night, everybody.
Yeah, same to you. Thank you very much.